This podcast is brought to you by our Supreme Boiler of Leather, Morgan. If you want to find out how to become a Supreme Boiler of Leather or how to get access to the exclusive Patreon content, check out patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. Hello everyone and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Stefan Sasse, I am your illustrious host for this evening, and I have an equally illustrious co-host with me today who will now introduce himself.
Hello, equally illustrious, I like that. I am Michael, also known as Bookshelf Stud. I am one of the hosts of the Maester Monthly podcast, which is the podcast hosted by the moderators of the Song of Ice and Fire subreddit. That's my main claim to fame. That and just writing and being in the Song of Ice and Fire fandom for like 7 years now, I think. It's been quite a while. It's been consuming quite a lot of my life for a while. That's probably how you know me, or just from Twitter, you know. I'm very funny.
Absolutely. I can only recommend checking out your Twitter handle and following you. So will you tell all our nice listeners where to find you on Twitter?
Absolutely. You can find me at Bookshelf Stud. My website is offmichaelsbookshelf.wordpress.com because I'm too cheap to pay for hosting without the WordPress part in the URL. You can also, like I mentioned, Maester Monthly is the podcast that I'm on, and that's at Maester Monthly on Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, iTunes, pretty much every major platform, including Spotify, as of recording, like as of a couple hours ago.
Very cool. And as you just mentioned it, I mean, this is obviously something that I'm totally immune of, like wasting your life away on talking about A Song of Ice and Fire and thinking about it. So we are partners in crime here, I guess. So the topic of today was chosen by our Patreons. I have this this new tradition basically opened up where I ask our new guest to propose out of a list that I prepare three topics, and then the Patreons can decide which one they want to hear about. And our Patreons forced us with their vote into the topic, the big themes and the big picture. And this will be a little bit of a freewheeling and dealing kind of thing. Because whatever we see as the big themes about A Song of Ice and Fire is, I guess, totally uncontested and not at all controversial when we talk about it. So we will see what we think will be basically what the story is about, really. And there are a lot of big swooping interpretations out there, you know. One of my favorites, this is not it, is like it's all a post-apocalyptic story and it's really about climate change. So we are not going in that direction because, no, it is. The Valyrians didn't have nuclear power and Song of Ice and Fire is not about climate change. I think we are in agreement on that.
There's a lot of and have been for a long time, a lot of like snake oil salesmen in the fandom who will promise to tell you the one weird trick to figuring out what the story is about, whether that's, I don't know, like bizarre moon myth stuff or post-apocalyptic things like you mentioned. That's a pretty I don't know. That one's pervasive. It pops up every once in a while like a weed. You think everyone's done, and then someone will be like, ah, but a Shai is actually a spaceship. and it's not. Yes, you're right. So I think we can cut that line of discussion off right now.
I mean, there are fantasy stories out there if you are in this kind of thing, but I don't think it's A Song of Ice and Fire. So we will not wade into the territory of those big theories that basically explain the plot to you, you know, like where you have this one key and then you unlock where all the threads are woven together. Rather, what we want to talk about are more the themes. So what is, on a sub level, what is the story about? It's the stuff that you had in school, in high school, you know, your literature teacher, what he made you write essays about. This, that's basically the thing. And I want to propose that one of the monumental things that the whole thing is about in one capacity is war and peace, and the question of what it really is. You know, what is war? What is peace? And how is it in relation with each other? Because this is a major topic that Martin discusses, and I don't think this is controversial either. I think the controversial part is to see what does he say about it. You know, there are a lot of people who claim it's basically a pacifist story, that it is an anti-war story, and some people hotly debate this claim. So where do you come down on this debate? Is it an anti-war story or not?
I don't think it is an anti, or at least not a pacifist story. I think Martin himself has spoken before about his own, he's probably more of a pacifist himself, but has also made comments about how, you know, I'm a pacifist except for World War II. Like, I wanted to kill Nazis. You know, he sometimes sees the value and justice in violence, which is definitely present in the story itself. He also reflects the glory of war. I think that's one of the things the story really captures, is that, you know, we're going to be talking about dichotomies a lot today, I think, because ice and fire, all that kind of stuff, war and peace, but that war can be both glorious and horrible. That you can have, you know, these fantastic things happening, like the charge of Renly's ghost at Blackwater, which when Ser Dantos is talking about it in book two, he's just over the moon excited about this because it's something right out of a song. But we know the gory cost of that song, and we know what it looked like on the ground, and all of the you know, dismembered people and Tyrion's missing nose and all these horrible, horrible things. Not to mention the, you know, wildfire explosion. So I think war is presented as more complex than just kind of anti-war. It's not just horrible. There's an attraction to it, and that's what draws people to it in the story. It's a way for, particularly in Westeros, it's a way for men to express power on the world. But it can be glorious as well as awful, which is something, like I said, we're going to come back to a lot, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the one passage that captures this dichotomy the best is the monologue that Sir Eustace has in The Sworn Sword, where he talks about the Red Fire Rebellion. I don't think it gets more explicit than when he's talking about the Red Grass Field, you know, how all the people died, how he lost his own son, I think it is, who died there. And then he goes on about how the sun was, I don't know, was it setting or rising? I think setting over the red grass field, and that it was this sublime moment of beauty, basically. And this is something that you get from a lot of firsthand accounts. It came to me from a rather a different source when I finally got around watching They Shall Not Grow Old. I don't know if you know it. There's a documentary by Peter Jackson. He basically colorized video from World War One, and the whole movie is held together by veterans of World War One recounting their stories. And this is it's quite a weird viewing experience, at least for me, because I'm not really predisposed to see the glorious point of war. And they are a lot about, yeah, it was horrible, and the mud and the dirt, etc. But then you also have these moments where you transcend everything, you know, where you are living in the moment, and you really breathe the air, and you feel the earth, and your heart pounding, and all that kind of things that I guess you can only really treasure if you really felt them once. You know, you can't really talk about it unless you experienced it thing. So I get this part on an intellectual level, but I always had difficulty feeling it because it's alien to my life experience, which of course doesn't take away from the literature, but that makes it difficult for me to access this part of the story.
Yeah, no, I it's funny you say that, because I can think of a George R. Martin quote where he mentioned how him presenting the glories of war like gets him in trouble with the other side of the political spectrum, with you know, sort of people who are more prone to pacifism and things, and that, you know, there are people who are kind of angry at him almost for presenting the glory of it. It's a hard thing to recognize, especially, you know, like you say, if you don't have that personal connection to it, seeing, you know, banners stirring in the wind and everything. It's one thing to read about that. It's probably another thing to actually experience it and feel that glory of war, quote unquote. I mean, 90% or most of us, I would say, are just not at all ever encountering in our daily lives.
And this would lead into my first thesis, so to speak, which would be that while he certainly presents both sides, it's not even-handed. So the parts about war being this Moloch, this really bad experience that just gobbles people up and spits them out again, or outright destroys lives, existences, social fabric, all of that, like you get 10 scenes of those to one scene that depicts the glory and the quote-unquote good parts about it. And if I always get this impression when we are talking about Martin's text, which is why I'm not mad at him for presenting it this way, is that he shows the good aspects more or less as a problematic side effect of the thing. You know, this war is bad, but the problem is there are also cool parts on it. You know, like recognizing that the good effects are not exactly a redeeming factor at all. They just complicate the picture.
Yes. Yeah.
Does this make sense?
Definitely. And I think, you know, another thing we're going to probably mention the word dragons a lot, I expect. And I think dragons really kind of embody that in a very, like, you know, fantasy is all about making the metaphor literal, and that's definitely present in dragons because they look so cool. Tyrion loves dragons. You know, he's reading stories about them, and how can you not love dragons? But also, dragons are nuclear weapons that lay waste to countries and, you know, indiscriminately murder civilians. And that, I think, right there is the war and peace problem where, like you said, the cool part, the good quote unquote parts of it are aesthetics, really. The bad part is the core of it, is what it actually does in the world. There's definitely a lot more strident imagery about the horrors of war, especially in the later two books. And I think he tends to, even when he presents something glorious, tends to undercut it in some way. If you know, thinking back to like the prologue of the first book, when Waymar Royce has his dance with me then moment, you know, he's challenging the others, he gets immediately gibbed. I mean, he's taken out almost instantly and is also kind of a jackass the rest of the time. It's a flash of glory and impressiveness amidst just a sea of ugly, horrible death and terrible things.
When we leave war aside for a moment and look at the iconography of the thing, because you just mentioned dragons look cool, and I think this plays a large role, because you brought a comparison that is very common in fandom, and we discussed it here on the podcast as well, is the dragons as nuclear weapons metaphor. And I mean, look at the communist dictatorships in the Cold War. They try to make nuclear weapons look cool. If you look at these parades over Red Square in Moscow, they always showed off the rockets and the missiles on those trucks, and these displays of raw power. They speak to something inside of us, you know. There's nothing like a military parade, basically. I mean, Trump is definitely onto something when he wants a military parade. I think he's in the wrong country for it. But still, it is quite obvious that this is something that gets at us. And our society today isn't quite as receptive as earlier societies had been with this whole military parade thing and displays of military power in general. But just look at the Game of Thrones TV series. I mean, all those money shots of dragons, they are friggin' awesome. You know, they go over something and they burn it down and it looks so good.
The Spoils of War episode alone, just, you know, who amongst us didn't get chills watching that, you know? Because they're lying if they say they didn't.
And this plays a major role. And at the same time, every time those dragons show up, you are hit in the head with the consequences of it. You know, how they basically destroy things and people, and they burn, and burning is a really bad way to die. And all of that makes it difficult to absorb the sheer glory of it. Much more difficult, for example, than in A Lord of the Rings, where the killing and the dying is always like one hit with the sword and you're out. And this is definitely not the case in A Song of Ice and Fire. Dying is very ugly here, even the TV show.
Certainly, yeah. Yeah, it's that's definitely part of the reason for George writing the story is to upend some of those really classic, like you said, you know, just mowing down hordes of orcs without any sort of worries about orc babies or how horrible it must be to die to Aragorn's sword. Yeah, no, none of that in A Song of Ice and Fire, really. It's all very much subverted. not to use the word that everyone uses to describe the books and the show, subverted, but it's definitely part of the reason behind everything.
I also think that aside from the monologue of Sir Eustace, most memorable lines go to the destructiveness of it. I mean, think of Septon Maribald.
I actually, the only time I've met George R. R. Martin, I got him to sign that page in A Feast for Crows, with the broken man speech. I don't mean to interrupt, but yeah, it's definitely a like just immensely cool part of the story.
And it's also, I don't know why the broken man speech is so so influential, basically, but it gets to a lot of people. I think of Emmett Booth, who is always constantly talking about it, Stephen Atwell, Jim McGean, everyone who concerns themselves with this question of war in Song of Ice and Fire always comes back to Septon Maribald, because his speech just gets to a reality and a deeper truth, basically. That is also one of those that eludes us, because again, we are not accustomed to war anymore, and so the psychic toll that it takes on us, this whole idea of completely breaking, is generally something that gets not explored enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's quite a mission statement, and it's probably as close as I don't necessarily hew to like the show don't tell advice all the time, because I think that's a little over prescriptive, but I think this is as close as George gets to telling us what he's thinking about war in these books, as opposed to just showing us by, you know, showing us all these horrible battles where people, you know, break and die and run away and everything. But yeah, this is him kind of almost pulling back the curtain a little bit, I think, is what it feels like to people, and saying, hey, this is what I'm thinking about. This is some of what's on my mind. This is some of what should be on your mind as you read through this book. The costs of war, and very much the cost of war and power to the innocent people, which is something that gets repeated several times. You know, why is it that the innocents must die when the High Lords play their Game of Thrones? The life of one bastard boy against a kingdom, all these kind of these ideas of the nameless people suffering for not really any good reason.
I also think that the character of Septon Maribald is Martin's way of separating this suffering and the consequences of war firmly from the political plot. Because if you think of A Clash of Kings, we see the suffering of the small folk mostly through the eyes of Arya. And in A Storm of Swords, we also get a little bit of Jaime's very warped perspective on matters. But it is very easy, and I think I made that, let's call it a mistake as well, when I read it the first time, it's very easy to basically attribute all the horridness to the Lannisters. You know, there are some small things like these, they lay with lions a bit, and a little bit about the Karstarks, but they're also evil in a way. So until A Feast for Crows, all the atrocities get basically piled up on the Lannister side. And Sept Maribald, his function in the story, more or less, at this very specific point in a book that's called A Feast for Crows, helps us to ground all of it in a way that is divorced from the political plot in a total manner. And I think this may be one of the reasons why its impact is so strong compared to the showing that he did before. You know, this over the head telling, as you just said, it is necessary, I guess, in a way. Like when Daenerys gets her speech from the Green Grace about pieces to pearl without a price, which is, of course, its own problem, and I think we'll get to that in a minute. But there are those elements of directly talking to the audience by way of talking to the main character, basically. And this can be a very
problem. Definitely. And you know, its location in the story is important, too. I think it serves as kind of a counterbalance to, like, the North Remembers in Book 5, which is, you know, we talk about the glories and all that, and you don't get any more glorious than Wyman Manderly turning out to be, you know, a Stark loyalist, but counterbalanced by Septon Maribald's speech, suddenly that has a lot more depth, because we know that Wyman Manderly marching off to war isn't just like, oh, hooray, we're going to liberate, you know, everybody and everyone's going to be happy. It's, oh my God, he's like starting another war, like more pitched battles will happen where peasant boys get their legs cut off. It's, you know, it does. It adds some weight to some otherwise just unabashedly glorious moments in the books surrounding it. There's a cost to the you know, climb towards power that a lot of these characters are chasing.
It's also having this dark underbelly of very lower motivations, basically, because Wyman Manderly, yes, he is a Stark loyalist and all of that, but primarily he is motivated by revenge. He's not starting this war to set up a political system. That's a duty he basically throws into Stannis' lap, you know, like, give me back my liege lord and then you can do whatever you want. I want to go out there with my army and kill Freys. That's his mission statement. He wants to kill people, as many as he can, and in possibly very horrid ways, like when he makes the three Freys into Frey pies, for example. And a lot of people are acting on these darker impulses when they use the war that on a higher level, like Robb Stark, for example, he's waging war with very high-minded principles in mind, basically. First it's rescuing Ned, and then it's for Northern independence. But when you look at people like the Karstarks, they are fighting for revenge at this point. You have Roose Bolton, who is fighting to get a leg up in Northern politics and couldn't give less of a shit about the political thing. You have all those Riverlanders who are basically in it to save their own hides and maybe take a little bit of land in the bargain. Then you have Armory Lodge and all of those types who simply sate their lust for violence and sadism, and all of that gets thrown into one big maelstrom.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, when Big Bucket Wool in Book 5 is, you know, I want to bathe in Bolton blood before I die. That's not like a, yeah, like you're saying, that's not like a high-minded, principled approach. You know, it's not like, I would really like to oppose the Bolton tax policies in some way. No, I mean, he just wants to like cut open Roose Bolton, like one of those Viking eagle things, one of those blood eagle things. You know, he just, yeah, it's this very like base emotion driving a lot of the supposedly complex political machinations. Really, it's people who want to like hurt other people, sometimes in return for being hurt themselves.
We even have this very explicit in the East, where Daenerys is trying to liberate slaves, and then she has to constantly put up with Dario Naharis, who tells her basically, like, there's nothing like killing an enemy and then fucking a nice girl. You know, he couldn't give less of a shit about Dany's crusade. And there are many people like this in those coalitions. And whenever you give in to them or even do not check them actively, they can take over at any time. And also, these people have a lot of problems when the immediate military goal is achieved. as in Daenerys's case, because then we have to question, what now? The same thing is after the Battle of Castle Black with the Wildlings. Now the battle is over, and now what? You know, and that leads to the question of peace, which dominates A Feast for Crows and A Dance with Dragons, because the question of what do you do after is the really hard part that gets excised from most fantasy. And that leads us into our second big theme, the question of peace. So my question to you would be, is it the pearl without a price?
Is it the pearl without a price? I mean, it's funny because peace in the story is so fragile, especially like you were just mentioning books 4 and 5. The peace that we see in Westeros in book 4 is obviously built on just atrocity after atrocity, the Red Wedding kind of being the centerpiece. But, you know, every battle is kind of an atrocity in its own right. The same with the peace in Meereen, you know, quote unquote peace in Meereen, where it's built on conquest and it's built on subjugation. And that kind of keeps this going, keeps this like cycle of violence going. And I mean, yeah, the peace is such a hard thing to attain in this story. It almost, you know, makes you wonder how Robert's Rebellion ever ended, how there weren't just holdout lords warring and warring for years. But I don't know. Yeah, peace is it's a dream of spring. it's a distant dream, one that I think the story is telling us that characters should work towards and try to attain anyway. But yeah, it's an uncapturable objective, it seems.
I think the comparison you just made is instructive, because you brought up Robert's Rebellion. Like, how did it end? It ended basically by Robert not having a grudge, unless he were a Targaryen, of course. But everyone else got an outstretched hands. They lost a few castles, and maybe they had to give up hostages. But by all accounts, it was very, very mild. And he basically offered business as usual. Whereas when you look at the pieces that are made, is this a plural form pieces? The pieces that are made in the Dance with Dragons, especially, but also in A Feast for Crows, are more of the Roman variety. You know, with this whole we make a desert and call it peace, but they are not even making a desert; they are just piling on some atrocities. And I mean, the Romans at least knew that you had to kill everyone if you wanted to do this, but this is not what it's done. What's done, right? When Jaime rides through the Riverlands and gives into this delusion of himself as Golden Hand, basically, where he tries to play act Ned Stark more or less, and what he does is being an occupation force, basically. He is bringing his will and that of his father, a peace built on a breach of all taboos and norms, and that is imposed at sword's length. And you can already see in A Feast for Crows that it will not last long. I mean, even Jaime doesn't really give into this illusion. When he makes peace, quote unquote, between Blackwoods and Brackens, you just know the first opportunity, these guys will be at each other's throat again. In Derry, this is crying out, like you can count down the weeks until there is war again in Derry, and so on and so forth. We do not even start to talk about the North, where there is full-blown civil war still on underway. There is no peace to be had with the Ironborn, and so on and so forth. And in Meereen, you have the same thing. Dany is leaving Yankai behind, and the second she passes by Yankai, they are training the next army. So how do you actually make peace? And and the question is, why is Martin framing it like this? You know, why do these people fail at producing a lasting peace? What is he trying to tell us here? What's the theme, basically?
When I think about the theme of Songrest Fire, and particularly with regards to this question about, like, you know, you're faced with a choice, right? You're faced with a choice of, like, whether or not to keep trying to do what you think is the right thing, even if, you know, clearly it's not working, everyone hates you. The scene that I always come back to is, again, from book 4, Brienne in the rain at the end of the crossroads, where, you know, she draws her sword, 7 against 1, no chance and no choice. That no chance and no choice ethos, I think, is, I guess, I don't think George R. R. Martin is cynical enough to be writing a story where he's saying it is worthless to try and do the right thing, to try and make peace. You should just, like, jump on life like a roller coaster and ride it to the end. Because that's, like, what Roose Bolton does, or Ramsay. That's, that, you know, these people who really don't give a hoot as long as they're profiting in some way, and profit can mean, you know, actual profit, or it can mean just having a good time flaying people. I think the sort of the theme that we're circling around is more in line with Brienne at the inn, where even if, knowing that she has no chance of winning against these overwhelming odds, she still has to go out there every day. She still has to go out there and try and make things right. I think it's important in that scene that it's 7 against 1. It's the 7 kingdoms against this one person who is trying to, you know, bring them down, bring them to peace, or whatever, you know, however you want to stretch that metaphor. And yeah, she stands no chance, but also she has no choice but to try and do the right thing. So that's kind of where I see it anyway. This kind of romantic in like the poetic sense. You know, like I said, I don't think he's as cynical as some people make him out to be saying, well, you know, this is all nihilistic. At least I don't see the story going in that direction. And I certainly don't think that the show's ending suggests nihilism exactly. So I don't think the books will either. You know, depending on how people can take those, take the show to suggest the ending of the books and how much that works.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I don't think nihilism is much in the cards here. And I would argue that peace has basically been tried to achieve wrongly, basically. Every one of the people we watch trying to make peace makes one large mistake that's more or less rooted in who they are. For example, Jaime can never renounce his family and the crimes that his family's fortunes are built upon. So how does he propose to make peace, really? Why would anyone ever see him as anything else than a Lannister stooge? John can never get out and try to compromise with his own people. And Danny has this whole problem of not really... I don't even know how to do this, because this gets into the deeply controversial question of what is the right historical parallel for the marine plot. And I'm basically with Stephen Atwell here, saying it's reconstruction. And in this case, we would be mostly on the page of she should have hanged the slavers, basically. They are getting off too light. You know, she's trying to have it both ways, and she is... more or less disappointing everyone, whereas John is trying to get out one radical thing and compromises too little in some way, or at least gives... No, I don't even... I wouldn't even go so far to say he compromises too little, but he isn't aware enough of the internal opposition that he has and doesn't take enough steps to mitigate it.
Right, sure. That, you know, the coalition building... part of John's piece isn't really there. You know, he just, Beau and Marshall bring up something that's a problem, and John will be like, so what? I said this, do this instead. Whereas, as you know, like you said, Danny is really bending over backwards for these people who a couple months ago enslaved thousands of individuals. I think it's also, you know, coming back to Jaime as well, you know, it's really stark, really stark, how he tries to build the Riverlands piece on dead children the way Robert's reign was built on dead children. You know, he threatens to kill Edmure's child, which is, you could argue, kind of like the original sin of Robert's reign, is that it was built on dead children. It was built on these dead Targaryens. And I think there's something really interesting in the story about people who keep trying to build institutions and power structures built on harming children, specifically children, innocents in general, but usually children. It's almost, you know, it brings to mind that Ursula Le Guin story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, about, you know, this utopian city where at the center of the city is this child who is being tortured, basically, to keep the city a utopia. And, you know, coming back to that, what is the life of one bastard boy against a kingdom that, you know, I think as long as peace is being built on violence against children, then it's an illegitimate peace, which is, just to go on a soapbox for a second, the reason Varys is not all that he's cracked up to be. Like, I don't think he's this for the realm ideological purist he claims to be, because his idea of peace is built on, you know, hundreds of children with their tongues torn out so that he can build his power. Just throwing that one out there for all the Varys fans, trying to make them as angry as possible.
Are there so many? Because I always get the impression that Martin is pretty clear on Varys being wrong, basically. I don't see much sympathy in the text for Varys. You find sympathy for Jon, you find sympathy for Dany in all their mistakes, maybe even Jaime, but not really. There it is more the sympathy of why he fails in all his flaws and stuff. But Varys, I don't see how anyone can get the impression that this is the secret good guy of the story, you know? So this about peace. So let all the martial things behind in the dust for a moment and jump into a whole different thing, which has to do with the cynicism that we just touched in passing. Because if there is one thing that many people are convinced about, it's that life is not a song, and that basically you have to have this ultra cynical outlook on the world in order to survive the Game of Thrones. And that is the ultimate lesson, you know. If you have emotions, if you have principles, if you have honor, if you want good relations to people, etc., then you are dumb and you deserve to get down. And I am not convinced.
Yeah, no, right. Honor is for suckers. Yeah, Ned Stark was dumb. No, yeah, that's you talk about like prevailing fan attitudes, that's a pretty big one. People who read that into the story, I think rather the lesson is that it's easy to be cynical. It's easy to be faced with like the horrors of reality and just, you know, just be Sandor Clegane in books 1-3. You know, just shut down. It's harder to choose to like continue, to come back to the no chance and no choice thing. And like, I think the show maybe more so than the books did linger a little more on that kind of cynicism, on the Ned Stark is dumb school of thought, that honor is dumb and things like that. I don't know. It's only there in the text if you choose not to look further, I think. You know, if you choose not to think about the story besides those things. And also the story in the books, at least, isn't over. You know, is when we look at cynical characters in the books, Littlefinger is like the primo cynical guy, in the sense that, you know, he is, if you're a weird cynical fan, he's your hero because, you know, he's smarter than everyone else and he doesn't give in to these, you know, superstitions or romantic stories or anything. He just plays the game. And I do rather think he's going to get taken down. And also, you know, you can't get any more on the nose than Tywin Lannister himself, his cynical ass corpse stinking to high heaven because he's just so full of it. You know, again, that's pretty on the nose in terms of like, hey, this guy who was really cynical and, you know, said the whole thing about the dozen at dinner and all that, that guy is full of it. Don't listen to him. His legacy is rotting and falling apart. That's right there in the text, you know. It's pretty present.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me go back to Littlefinger for a second, because like Varys, there is a smaller subset of people who think that basically he is right, more or less, and that is the general theme of it. You know, honor is for suckers, and you just need to, chaos is a ladder, and all of that. And I think it is right there in the text that Littlefinger is also full of it, because while he is always saying, like, life is not a song and don't trust into the romantic stuff, etc., he is a romantic at heart. He is still in this whole mindset. He has just convinced himself and is trying to convince everyone else that he isn't. But really, he is emotional as fuck. I mean, Varys is pretty cold. And can basically shove his own prejudices and stuff away, but Littlefinger can't. Not for a second. I mean, he's risking everything just to stick one more jibe into Eddard Stark all the time during a Game of Thrones and all that kind of stuff. So I think Martin is critiquing it through the person of Littlefinger.
100%. I mean, Martin has said before about how there's a lot of Jay Gatsby in Littlefinger. And I mean, yeah, that's it exactly. Is Littlefinger is masking his deep romantic desire to be Brandon Stark, to be like the big strong guy who gets the girl, and you know, all these things. He's masking that with this cynicism, but it's not real. It's this performance he's putting on. I would agree 100%. That Gatsby tradition.
And at the same time, I also think that Sansa will ultimately be vindicated in her whole approach of this. If I am ever queen, I want people to love me thing that she very purposefully and very deliberately puts against Cersei's you need to be feared theory of government, basically. And again, look at who is arguing for this. You only have to look at who is making the statements to see what Martin is thinking about those. A quiet land, a quiet people is Bolton. Then you have to rule through fear is Tywin and Cersei. On the other hand, all the good people get maybe flawed versions, maybe unworkable versions, but they still get the aspirational stuff. So I would definitely see this as proven by the text, more or less. And Martin has also said on multiple occasions, and the text bears it out, that romanticism plays a major role in this. He is critiquing some of it and exploring it from different angles and also putting a price tag on it, more or less. But he's not saying it's for losers.
I would agree with that. Yeah. I mean, you know, speaking of Sansa, is it all right to mention Winds of Winter sample chapters, by the way? Just wanted to, I guess, I figured I just didn't, you know, wanted to give people a warning. But from the Elaine sample chapter where she's putting together the Tournament of the Winged Knights, that in and of itself is such a nice little summary bullet point statement for how you can use romance and story and song for good ends. You know, she's taking the story of the Winged Knight, which is Lord Robin Arryn's favorite story, and she's turning it into a way to like bring the Vale together to make some houses happy by giving their, you know, second sons these impressive sounding titles of winged knights, to, you know, basically build coalitions and all that, which is, you know, as we mentioned, a skill that Jon is kind of lacking. This is Sansa's path forward, and I think Sansa will definitely be a really important lens for pushing back against the like really cynical Littlefingerian facade that we see so much of. So yeah, Sansa, all the way.
So that basically does it for the romanticism and the classical fantasy things. So one thing that I noted for the big themes and the big picture is gender roles. I'm not quite certain how much Martin intended when he started writing this in 1993 because this is the time way before this has become a major issue, right? I mean, it takes over 20 years for this to break through to the surface of mainstream discussion. But there is a lot of it going on in A Song of Ice and Fire. You know, this critiquing of traditional gender roles, of pushing people into them, the price of of patriarchy, of toxic masculinity, of toxic femininity in a way. All of it is in the text. Would you agree, or do you think I'm reading too much into it as a progressive of 2019?
No, I would agree. I mean, I don't necessarily know that George R. Martin himself is sitting there going, well, I really want to represent, you know, third wave feminism in this novel, and I have to be very intersectional. I don't know that he's sitting down intentionally painting things in, but I think that he is capturing a patriarchal society in a really accurate and honest way, such that he captures how the patriarchy damages everyone. One of my fellow moderators on the subreddit, who goes by the username Mighty Isabel, that's a drum that she'll beat a lot, is that one of the big ideas in the story is just how the patriarchy really hurts everyone. It hurts Sam, it hurts John, it hurts Danny, it hurts every character. And I personally, I think there's something really interesting going on with, and this is about, maybe this is going to get a little too far into the clouds, but, you know, swords in this story are really stand-ins and metaphors for power. You know, Lightbringer as the forged sword is obviously, that can be a metaphor for a number of things like the Night's Watch or institutions. The man who passes the sentence should swing the sword itself representing, you know, this institutional power again. And swords are, not to get too Freudian, pretty wiener looking. They're phallic symbols. And I think that's something that's really interesting going on in the story, with something between swords and the patriarchy and institutions and how they damage people. I don't know. I feel like it's kind of a word salad right now, or just kind of like a word cloud, but it feels like such an important part of the story. The way it's not just that, you know, that power hurts people, but that this patriarchal power is hurting people in specific ways that you can see echoed throughout generations.
If I had to phrase my approach about analyzing the character of Eddard Stark in one sentence, it would be the benign patriarch. And I think Eddard Stark is more or less the pinnacle of patriarchy. He is everything a good patriarch could be, and what he does is still deeply damaging to people around him, even though he's doing it with the purest and best intentions at heart. So I definitely agree, the patriarchy is hurting everyone. This is as much to a major theme as I would make out, like on the same level basically as the war and peace stuff we talked about. And I think this is the most controversial part of it, but I do agree all about swords as phallic symbols and swords as power, etc. I think this merits an episode all on its own. All of this gendered stuff and the metaphors that go around it, the same is true of gowns and making them by yourself, what young women do, and there is a lot to it, is what I'm saying, and I definitely agree that it is all in the text. But you also mentioned in passing, more or less, the nature of power and the price of power, and this is also something, I guess, that is a major theme that gets, and a major topic that gets discussed in A Game of Thrones, because some people do reject power when they have the chance to get it, and the price that you pay, kill the boy and let the man be born and all of that, you know, everyone who gets power in this story pays with character integrity. The people who keep their personas intact, who remain innocent, like Sam, they don't wield power. Everyone who gets it gets marred in some way, gets hurt by it, and hurts others in return. It's basically unavoidable. Why do you think that is?
I mean, there's this quote from Dalla, Mance's wife, shortly before she dies, where she describes magic as a sword without a hilt. And I think that extends to power in the story as well. You can't grip it without cutting your hands. It does. It damages everyone who takes power, because power, generally what we're talking about is power over other people. You know, power by itself is kind of a nebulous concept, so power over other people. And anytime you have power over other people, that damages you and damages them. And I mean, I'm not saying George is an anarchist necessarily, that, you know, all power structures are bad and must be torn down, but rather that it's when people sort of lack the autonomy to control themselves that you start to see this damage that goes both ways. There's one of my favorite examples of this from the story is of Jane Westerling and Lysa Tully, how they both intended to sire children with their true love. Lysa, it was Littlefinger, and Jane, it was Rob. And both of them, their children were either aborted or prevented with Moontie for the sake of power, for the sake of their house's power, for Hoster Tully's power, for Sybil Westerling's power. You know, the way that they lack autonomy over their bodies, and then that autonomy is being sacrificed for greater power. I think that's right at the heart of the story. And obviously that decision, you know, we see Hoster Tully on his deathbed is now racked with guilt over this, you know, muttering tansy, tansy over and over again. It's something that scarred him, not nearly as much as it scarred his daughter, but something that damaged him as well. And so I find that to be a really useful example, I guess, of how power in the story, it hurts people who are powerless, but also it damages and eats at the people who wield power over others. There's a reason I think that he dies from cancer in the story, you know, that he's eaten inside by this terrible thing that he did. So anyway, yeah, cheery stuff. But yeah, that's I think the cost of power is abomination, is doing abominable things or becoming abominable yourself.
I would definitely agree. And in Hoster Tully's case, I think it's still under-analyzed in the fandom, the specific relationship that the Tully family had inside itself. But also, I think that's a whole episode on itself. But you are absolutely right about everything you just said. And so my last question feeds directly into this about when we talk about the themes. And it gets also very explicit in the text in A Clash of Kings, which is the nature of power. There is the famous riddle that Varys puts to Tyrion, you know, where does power ultimately come from and what is it? And he answers it with this shadow on the wall thing. I think Martin also goes to a lot of places in trying to discover where power comes from, how it is exercised, and why. And this will ultimately, just as a last thesis that I want to throw out before we go into this discussion, this ultimately will feed back, if we can take this the series as a guide, into the whole romanticism thing, because who holds power in the end? It's the storyteller, right? So all of this, I feel, is there to give us a very specific idea about the nature of power. So what's your take on this?
On the nature of power itself. Well, I mean, you know, like I was saying, power over other people is such an important part of what we've seen so far in the story. And we see the way like wills are stripped away from, you know, in the most extreme example, the others obviously strip the will of the dead, strip their souls away. But, you know, when we describe kind of good power, I think we can see good examples of power when individuals kind of give of themselves, when they swear a vow of their own volition, not under duress. You know, the quote unquote power of, say, Catelyn over Brienne, it doesn't feel like power because, I mean, Catelyn does order her around, but it's not this antagonistic relationship where it harms the both of them. It improves their lives because Brienne willingly swears herself to Catelyn and Catelyn willingly takes on Brienne. And I think that kind of thing is really where, I don't know, where we can see examples of power as positive. I mean, like I said, it doesn't even feel like power, because when we hear power, we think of these like harmful hierarchies and things, which again is what most of the story presents to us, harmful hierarchies and power structures.
But at the same time, can we go without power? I mean, is it possible to view a society that doesn't have it? Because Martin is showing us the wildlings who claim that basically they only give power freely and they can't take it away at any time. But this is what they say, and what we get shown is quite different, really. So how much do we actually need? Because I do not see Martin as the social revolutionary who says we need an anarchist society without any power. I think we get a more differentiated picture here. That sounds awfully condescending, but I hope you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. No, I do, yeah, and I would agree. I think the show, you know, people don't necessarily like taking the end of the show as how the books will end, but I think one really important sort of nugget from the end of the show is that Bran and Tyrion, as King and Hand, enter into those offices for the first time in Westerosi history as servants, basically. You know, this is like Tyrion's public service that he's doing. Public service in the sense of like he went to prison and was sentenced to pick up trash on the side of the road, except he's not picking up trash. He's the Hand of the King. And Bran, too, is, you know, he's serving. He's not seizing power. He's not trying to continue a dynasty or anything like that. He's serving the realm. And I think that kind of service model of power I don't know. I mean, that seems to me like where we might find the most articulated vision for the future. Because like you said, the wildlings, you know, for as much as they talk about being the free folk, Faramir's prologue, at the very least, puts lie to that, because Faramir makes himself basically a monster king by virtue of the fact that he can warg into animals and things, and, you know, he can impose his will freely because there's no one to stop him. And, you know, the free folk, so the free folk don't represent then some sort of utopian society, which I think was a smart move on George's part to add some nuance and some differentiation in there. But yeah, like I said, the public service aspect for Bran and Tyrion, that really, I don't know, that one has stuck with me a lot since the finale, and has been something I've been thinking about a lot, because it's such an interesting concept and really only bubbles up right here at the end.
Yeah, I think monarchy especially gets dissected quite thoroughly, let's say, because then the normal system of monarchy, like the historical thing where the eldest son always inhabits, yada yada, it is really not shown as being something we should have, more or less. And while elective monarchy presents quite a lot of problems, and I'm not sure if the books will go there as well, it is, I guess, a leg up in some ways, at least. So,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I think that's true too, that, you know, we aren't going to get a story that ends with suddenly it's transformed to a perfect utopia, but rather, you know, just this slow progress. And, you know, it's Brienne walking out into the rain again. Maybe she'll kill a couple people. Maybe the kingdom will improve slightly. All they can kind of do is keep trying, which I think is really core to the story. It's that keep trying attitude. Keep pushing.
Progress is done in very, very small steps, and you cannot transform a society overnight. If you didn't believe that before, read John in ADVD again, and, well, it's right there in the text, basically. So that concludes it for me on the big themes. Did we miss anything? Is there something you want to talk about at the end?
You know, I don't think so. Like I said, it's the whole idea for me anyway of the suffering of the innocents, specifically children. I almost feel like you could do an entire like 50 episode podcast just going through the books and picking out how children are harmed in the story and how that plays into power dynamics. I mean, I think that's just such a really important part of what he's doing, and I'm looking forward to seeing how that continues in The Winds of Winter, frankly. I mean, not looking forward to, because it's going to be very upsetting, I'm sure. But, you know, looking forward to with a morbid curiosity.
Oh, yeah, that's true. By the way, it brings to mind this the statement by, I think it was Matthew Weiner, the producer and creator of Mad Men, who said that when you kill a child in a story, the story becomes about dead children. And I think this is a trap that Martin never really goes into, because he always knows that when you, in the service of your story, do kill children, you need to make this a point. And the way that dead children inform us on the psyche of the people who are involved and on how it transforms a society, you know, whenever someone in the story goes on to kill them, you know that shit basically got real. Then you have people on your hands who have crossed a line in some respect, you know? Yeah, because killing... like killing a farmer who is trying to protect his farm while you're looting is, I guess, one thing. It's one of those things that happen in war, basically. You know, both sides get pumped up, etc., etc. You can see how it happens. It's still a crime and all of that, but it doesn't make you into a monster. But at the moment, you are riding down a butcher's boy and then saying he didn't run very fast. In that moment, you cross the line. In some respect, and no amount of being gruff to Arya will bring you back, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. People who kill kids, that's crossing a Rubicon. That's putting yourself on one side of the moral spectrum, I would say. Yeah.
And we do, not yet at least, have people who do kill kids, and I think it will be a major waterline when Daenerys does it on purpose, basically, because she's burning cities. In that moment, she will cross a Rubicon of her own, and it will be a very important story arc for that reason alone. You know, killing children is, it should be done as a major turning point. And I think that's one of the things also that the show got pretty good. That they always made clear that it had consequences and that it was done by bad people.
Yeah, absolutely. They really stayed true to the books on that front. Yeah.
Okay. So once again, thank you very much for coming onto the podcast. And for people who already forgot it, please just restate, where can we find your stuff if we want to have more of you?
That's right. You can find me on Twitter at bookshelfstud. I'm also on Reddit under that username. My website or my blog is offmichaelsbookshelf.wordpress.com. And you can also find me on the Maester Monthly podcast hosted by the moderators of the Song of Ice and Fire subreddit. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been an absolute blast.
Yeah, once again, thank you. I always love these sessions. And if for some reason episode 91 of a podcast was the first one you ever listened to, go to patreon.com/boilleather audio hour to check out what's there. As you might have surmised by now, you can have a strong influence if you are a Patreon on what we are talking about next, what's going to be inside the episodes. You get access to all kind of bonus stuff, bonus podcasts, bonus essays, and all of that. So please, if you are not yet, check out the Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. Until next time, I'm going to see you, and you are going to listen to me and whoever I'm going to talk about with next. So bye bye until next time. This podcast was brought to you by our Patreons from the Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. The topic of the podcast was influenced by the Patreons as well, so if you are interested in having a say on what the topic of the next Boiled Leather Audio Hour will be about, check out the Patreon at patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. And if you are not interested in that, but interested in all the bonus content that you are getting, from exclusive essays to the audio version of said essays to early access to special podcasts and theory sessions and all of that, you can also check out the Patreon at, you guessed it, patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour. So hopefully I'm seeing you again soon on this very podcast, and until then, have a very nice day, a very nice week, and however long it is until the next episode arrives.